now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Wherever you are in the world at this time, welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity. Merry Christmas. Here we are, December 25th. Unbelievable. But we have made it this far, and we still have another week to go. So next week at this time, I'll be wishing everybody a happy new year. So everybody I talked to this past week or so, and even then some have said they're looking forward to 2021. And I say in just very simple response, yeah, but that's assuming that 2021 is going to be a lot better than 2020. So we have that going for us. We'll have to keep hoping against hope that 2021 is the year that we can turn it all around again. But still, this Christmas is different but unique. We will certainly have a lot of stories to tell about it, that's for sure. Well, as I said, welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity. Very excited to be with you here today. This broadcast is held every Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And it's all placed within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and certainly the relationship that we have with God or the divine. I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, please visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity, all one word there. And if you are listening today and like to be part of the show, I invite you to call in. I'll give you the number here. It's 888-627-6008, 888-627-6008. And again, I always love to talk to people who call in. So you do wish everybody a Merry Christmas. And these broadcasts, just in case you missed this one or can't sit through the whole thing, in case, you know, you want to go back and listen again, these broadcasts are podcasted. So you can certainly go in through the website and go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And for those of you who are new to the program, this is your first time listening, welcome. And I would just like to say, just always like to put it out there, just where I come from in these broadcasts. And part of the reason why I have named this these shows Reclaiming Authenticity is that I'm a firm believer that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything we need for this life in terms of our, let's say, our skills, our talents, our strengths, our giftedness, our character traits, and so forth. However, as we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may tend to hide this giftedness, or we push our giftedness way down so that others cannot see it. Or perhaps we were told when we were younger that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. And that's just garbage right there. But at any rate, when we do this, when we take into those kind of negative messages, we don't realize our giftedness. And we go through life functioning from a place of woundedness or this place of victimhood instead of a place of healing and learning and wholeness and embracing our hachetas or our uniqueness, as it's the literal translation of that. So, in fact, there is so much more to us than what we have become so far. And this is what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about. So helping people find the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Well, how is your heart today? I hope it is well, and you are well. I'll say it one more time. Merry Christmas to one and all. Hope you had a very pleasant Christmas Eve, and your Christmas day is going well. So, well, let's see. Where shall we begin? We're going to be talking about stars today and one very special star, the Bethlehem Star. But it just seems like over the past month, especially the last couple of weeks or so, all kinds of activity is going on in the skies these days and nights. Earlier this week, we celebrated the winter solstice, and then we had the alignment of Jupiter and Saturn, which a lot of people coined, the Bethlehem Star. Now we are reminded through the Christmas message of the Christmas Star itself. But there's been comets and meteor showers, and would you believe it or not, we have one more full moon to experience. I believe that comes up next Tuesday, the 29th. So before we get out of 2020, we still have one more full moon. So invite you to take advantage of that. And anybody, go on NORAD's Tracking Santa's website and see where Santa was when you looked up at your particular time. Last night, I got on the website, and it was somewhere around 7 o'clock in the evening, and Santa was just getting ready to pull into Venezuela. So, you know, I just kind of wished him well and turned it off and got busy with other things. But I don't know if you had done that or not, but it's always fun just, where is Santa Claus in the world? So, and certainly we have the positions of the moons and its phases, and I think all in all, we are a people just fascinated by what we see and hear in the heavens, whether it's daylight or we're looking at the night sky. You know, we're fascinated. We're always looking up. We're always paying attention. Hopefully that is. And we are trying to discern the signs of the times, as it were, just by what we see and what we hear. Well, let me kind of segue this into talking about stars. Think for a second. What's your favorite constellation? What's your favorite constellation? Do you have one? Well, as a boy, I would always enjoy the fall going into winter, because that is when I would be able to see my favorite constellation, Orion the Hunter. That's the constellation I always looked for as a boy, and to this day, I still look for it. In fact, I was out, it was a little bit cloudy here on the East Coast where I'm at, so I didn't have a clear night, but whenever there is a clear night and it's pretty brisk or cold, sure enough, I can find Orion in the south, and that's the constellation that just has always made me smile and just very easy for me to find. And like I said, I still look for it every winter. And I'm sure to share with you just a quick story. One of my favorite stories was told by my Aunt Patsy. And when our family would visit my mother's relatives in Massachusetts one summer, excuse me, she said she would often sit out in the yard with me as it was getting dark, and we would look up at the stars and we would name them. We would point them out. We would talk to them. We'd talk to each other. And she just had just fond memories of that. Well, she is no longer with us, going on some 15 years now, but she would always enjoy telling that story. It's just one of her favorite times, just how we talked about the stars and so forth. And I don't know if she gave me a love for looking at the stars at night, or maybe this was something that we brought into the world and we shared with each other. But at any rate, it's one of my favorite memories with my Aunt Patsy. So, getting back to Orion, because hopefully through science class we paid attention to this, but we know that because the Earth orbits the sun in the winter, we see the constellation Orion in the south at night. And then it also has a counterpart, which is hidden by the sun during the day, and that's Scorpius. But in the summer months, we see Scorpius in the night sky, and Orion is hidden by the sun. Okay, so if you ever want to see the Orion constellation, you have to wait for the winter. But if you want to see Scorpius in the night sky, we have to wait for summer. So the two just kind of mirror each other. They just go around and round as the Earth orbits the Sun. And I had other favorite constellations, too, as a boy, you know, like the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper, which is how I learned to find the North Star and why it's so important for people to know where the North Star is who sail the seven seas. And all we have to do is just use the Big Dipper's pointer stars at the end of the cup and to locate the North Star, and then we'll be able to find the end of the Little Dipper's handle. So again, that's always a nice thing for little kids to be able to discover. But what makes the North Star, or Polaris as it's called, so famous is because it holds its position while it appears that the entire northern sky moves around it. And this is great for navigation. You know, it just, this is true north. We are going the right way if we're going to head north. And the reason why it appears to hold its position is because it's almost located at the north celestial pole, the point around which the entire northern sky turns. And therefore, the North Star marks the way due north, as I said. But as you face the North Star, you can find the other directions because we just hold out our arms sideways and our right hand points to the east and our left hand points to the west. Now, what do you do if you happen to be living south of the equator? Well, then you have to use the Southern Cross constellation for your navigation. Quick, interesting story around that whenever sailors journeyed south of the equator, they found that the North Star started to disappear below the horizon. And as they sailed even farther south, the Big Dipper dropped out of sight as well. Well, fortunately, the Southern Cross constellation acts as this navigational aid, which is, I think, ironically, if you're familiar with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, they have an album entitled Southern Cross. People just call it the Southern Cross album. But they do mention this constellation and outsailing and how it guides people in, you know, the below the equator. Okay. Well, regardless of the culture and language or even geographical location, you know, humanity is in general is fascinated by the stars. We're fascinated by planets, we're fascinated by moons and their alignments. And we have learned to use them in various ways, such as I mentioned, for navigation. Well, perhaps the first use for the constellations was probably spiritual and religious. You see, ancient times, people believed that since God lived in the heavens, that God also created the stars. After all, I did a quick search this week, and I found over 60 references in the Bible alone that mentions stars, one of which states how God created the heavens and the earth and the sun, moon, and stars. Like I said, there's already 60 references in the Bible related to stars, so that's pretty significant. Okay, but it was back in 1543, perhaps you heard of this guy, Copernicus. He detailed his radical theory of the universe in which the Earth, along with the other planets, rotated around the sun. Okay, now up until that time, the Catholic Church at large, they taught that the sun revolved around the earth, and they based that teaching on God making the sun stand still during a battle in the Old Testament book of Joshua. And so to give the Israelites victory during that battle, God made the sun stand still. Okay, and so this is where the church teaching went. It's like, well, that proves it right there, that the sun revolves around the earth and everything else. You know, earth is the center of the universe. Well, when Copernicus comes around with his ulterior teaching based on science, the Catholic Church did not like it. And so they persecuted him, and then later Galileo, who also supported the claims, they persecuted him for this teaching. Yet it wasn't more than a century later that Copernicus's views became widely accepted. But that's for another broadcast, okay? So all in all, and over time, many cultures believe that the positions of the stars were God's way of telling stories. And I kind of like that. So it seemed natural to recognize patterns in the sky and to give them names or to tell stories about them. For example, to the Greeks, which is where we get most of our names for constellations, Orion was this great hunter. So when the constellations formed what they thought as this hunter, that's how he got his name. And he was also the son of Neptune, or the god of the sea. But the same constellation is also referred to as Osiris by the Egyptians. You see, every culture developed their own interpretation and stories that were attributed to what they saw in the night sky. And perhaps a more practical use for constellations was agriculture. Now, before there were proper calendars that we, you know, hang on our wall and everything, and the Farmer's Almanac, if you swear by it and you're not going to put something in the ground unless the Farmer's Almanac says so. Before those things, you know, people needed a way of determining when to sow their seeds or when to harvest. So they often watched the positions of the stars. And constellations made the patterns of the stars easy to remember. The ancient people knew, for example, that when the constellation Orion started to be fully visible, winter was coming soon. And the stars also allowed farmers to kind of plan ahead and plant and harvest their crops. And again, as I said, the constellations made it easier to recognize and interpret these patterns in the sky. So, since we humans are fascinated by the positions of the stars and the constellations they form, is it any wonder why God chose a bright star that lit up the night sky to announce the birth of Jesus? I mean, I don't believe that was by accident. After all, just look at who we have record of as following this star to see who or what it pointed to. Okay. I mean, first we have shepherds. I mean, who are they? They were out in the field, or depending on calendar, again, maybe not, because it might have been the rainy season. But anyway, we have shepherds. And these are the ones, as it's recorded, you know, were first visited by the angels. And they were told that, what this bright star was all about. So they agreed to go in search of this new thing that God was doing. And this was key. You know, the angels announced to them that God was doing something new. And they even said to each other, let's go and see this thing that God is doing. And so they set off to follow the star, which they were just outside Bethlehem, so it wasn't that too far of a trip for them. But they followed, nonetheless. And then next, we have the wise men, which now makes this Christmas story just a little bit more interesting. And these guys were just a bit of a mystery in and of themselves. We never hear of them other than this story. And there may have been many rulers or kings in their caravan. Typically we get three magi or three kings because of the three types of gifts they brought. You know, the gold, the frankincense, and myrrh. And in many Christmas traditions, this is why we give gifts to each other, because the wise men eventually showed up and gave gifts. But there could have been quite a number of kings or wise men. Well, if you do any kind of research, or just for curiosity, just Google, the Magi or the three wise men. And I would say probably the majority of research out there agree that perhaps these Magi were court advisors or astronomers from the eastern regions. And again, it's believed they came from Babylon, Persia, India, those places. And they used the stars to give guidance to their rulers. And these Magi understood the natural order, and they were able to explain this natural order to others in a way in which tied the spiritual to the ordinary or everyday life. And when they saw such a great shining star in the sky, of course, this would have been of great significance to these astrologer slash advisors slash wise men. Okay, but it's only in Matthew's gospel that we have record of the Magi, and I don't know how it happened, but of course, you know, people talk and word gets out, and the king in Israel of that time, you know, close to Bethlehem, was King Herod the First, and he was the ruler all of Judea, and he found out that the Magi were coming through. Like I said, who knows how he found this out, but he knew, or word got back to him, that they are searching for the King of the Jews. You know, where is this child who has been born King of the Jews? And they said to Herod, they said, "For we observed his star at its rising, and we've come to pay him homage." Okay, and here's where Herod could have got some information. Herod already learned that the place of Jesus's birth, you know, from prophecies that have been written, and of course the priests and the scribes in his court would have shared that information with him as well. And you know, this is, you know, looking at least the place of Jesus's birth, and so. Herod begins to question these wise men even more, and just exactly what time did this star appear, and so forth. And he just looked at that as a way to just confirm, you know, the prophetic writings of old. And then Herod dismisses them. He sends them to go see the infant Jesus, but he wants them to come back and disclose his exact location so that he can go and worship Jesus as well. But we all know from the story, Herod didn't really want to go and worship Jesus. He just simply wanted to kill Jesus because he saw his birth as a threat to his own rule. Okay, so anyway, the wise men continued on to Bethlehem, and when they found Jesus, they worshiped him, offered him gifts, the gold, frankincense, and myrrh, like I said. However, and this is the part I like, they were warned in a dream not to return to Herod. And so they left for their own country by another road. And this is where the story takes a very horrific, sad turn. Because once Herod found out, he was outwitted by the wise men, and they were wise for a certain reason. Herod snapped, for lack of a better phrase. He just went crazy, and he just sought to kill every child who was under 2 years old, every male child, and just a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, and just horrific times, all as a result of Herod wanting to hold on to his power. Well, it's interesting, whenever we not just look over Matthew's account of the Magi and the shepherds and so forth, but it's just interesting when we compare the responses of people. Now, here we have shepherds who are coming to see. We have wise men who have traveled a great, great, great distance to see, to worship, and then return home. And then we have Herod, who just, he doesn't want to hear it. He's just not drawn to Jesus at all. Okay, so two responses. You know, many are drawn and understand the significance, whereas others fear. They fear it, and they seek to eliminate it or seek to destroy it. Okay, and again, in Herod, we see this, you know, kind of this old theme of wanting to hang on to your power by any means versus those who surrender to a greater spiritual force at work in their lives. Well, let's go back to the idea that God was doing something new. I was told to the shepherds, new as in unlike anything anybody has ever seen before. And for me, whenever I, you know, come across that God is doing something new in a person's life, I always think of the movement or the direction of God. You know, and I ask these questions, you know, how is God drawing close to us or to this person? Or where is God drawing close to us? And what is the purpose or this new purpose that God wants us to pay attention to? You see, because whenever God moves towards us or draws close to us, this action or this behavior of God always requires a response on our part. You know, it's just something that we're just confronted with. We're either going to be attracted to it, or we're going to go away or run from God, or if we think we can, hide from God. Okay, and this asking these questions always brings me back to two theological themes or two words that have just been woven into just theology in and of itself, and that's immanence and transcendence. And you've heard me talk quite a bit about transcendence and just how it pulls us beyond our perceived limitations, and as a result, we often grow the most. But spend a little time with immanence. You know, if something is immanent, it exists or it operates within, it's inherent. And so the immanence of God refers to God's relationship to the world, that God actively operates within it and sustains it and is continually present. Okay. And God doesn't, you know, again, for lack of a better phrase, God just doesn't sit back and merely observe a creation, which he kind of set in motion, you know, just thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. And God is present. God's actively participating in this world. Nevertheless, God is immanent in creation, and these things depend upon God for their existence. So we can say on one hand, God is the creator, but God's also the redeemer and sustainer of life. And one of the ways people recognize the immanence of God is the way humanity tells stories by what they see in the sky. Remember I said a little while ago that, you know, looking at the stars, they believe that's how God tells God's story. And how we recognize that God is drawing close to us is the way, you know, humanity tells these stories, all by looking up, looking at the night sky. You know, what is God up to now? Or how does this relate to me? You know, I'm so small compared to the rest of the earth, let alone the heavens, but how does all this relate to me? Which, again, brings us back to now the other movement of God, this transcendence. And it's the transcendence of God that's more closely related to God's sovereignty. You know, it means that God is above, or God is other than and distinct from all that has been made, but yet God transcends it all and continually draws close to us. God goes beyond all that and still reaches out to us. In fact, this is kind of the basic definition of theology in and of itself, that the fact that God first moved towards us, or God first spoke, or God drew close to us, now we have to respond, or we want to respond. And that's the theological part of trying to understand what it is that God did, and now what is it that we are doing as a result. Okay, that's theology in a nutshell. Okay, and then we get very elaborate, and we flesh that out even more into very very nice compartments or stories or something that just flesh out, you know, what do we mean that God is continually in our lives each and every day? Okay, so what this means for us then, especially in terms of transcendence, is everything. Because whenever we are confronted or encounter what God is doing or how God is speaking to us. And you remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about dreams and how God often speaks to us in dreams. The responsibility is then placed on us to transcend or go beyond our limited perceptions. And in the story, that first Christmas story in Matthew's gospel, you know, the shepherds went away and they told others what they had seen and heard. You know, and that's all they did. And the Magi also went away and they told others. I mean, at any rate, we don't know what happened to these people throughout the rest of their lives. The story just drops off from there. They were just important enough to be included in the story. But then they went and told others and that was it. You know, and even though we don't know what happened to them, one thing is for certain. You know, they were forever changed by what God was doing in their lives. and they showed up. They were open. They were teachable. And, of course, they were forever transformed. And speaking of stories, I shared earlier how the ancient people believed that the stars and the constellations were, you know, God's way of storytelling. And so with any story, we are always brought to reflect further upon what we have read or what we have heard. And there are often hidden meanings or messages in the stories themselves, kind of like Dr. Seuss, okay? You know, it's more than just weird-sounding names or whatever else. There's always a moral to the story, you know, like Aesop's fables, same thing, okay? So there's always a moral or a lesson to the story, as it were. And a good story will always do this for us. If we're paying attention, there's always something that we can take from it. There's always something that, you know, should cause us, you know, pause to reflect and say, what has to change in my life? And how do I live out this awareness now, this consciousness I have about who Christ is, or this Christ consciousness? Well, we can certainly take our cue from the shepherds and the wise men, and we live out the Christ consciousness in everyday, ordinary society. And when we're able to do this, we turn the ordinary into the extraordinary. And kind of like finding God in the most unlikely places, in the most unlikely people. So, well, I would really love to hear your heart on the subject of hope and light and stars shining in darkness. So if you would like to call in, I would love to chat with you. The number again is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. And I will be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. And again, Merry Christmas to you and yours. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to share a quick word about next week's show. As I said, I will be here January the 1st, 2021. Yes, I'll be here next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And I'll be talking about storytelling, or how we tell stories and how we weave these stories into each one of our lives. Because often our stories overlap with somebody else, even if it's something negative that has happened. You know, we tell the story by telling the perspective of perhaps somebody else and what had happened in that particular moment. But it's how we tell those stories and what stories do we keep telling and retelling. Okay. So at any rate, as I said at the beginning of the show, oftentimes we don't realize our giftedness and we go through life functioning from this place of woundedness or victimhood, which is never, ever a good idea because we will be frustrated beyond our belief because we're going to keep making the same mistakes. We're going to come from that place of woundedness to where we'll just keep wounding others and wounding ourselves. But once we realize like that is going on, we now know how to not just, you know, tell a story, but we have healed, and we tell the story, the facts and the figures, more from a place of healing, from a place of wholeness. And we can truly embrace our uniqueness in spite of what has happened to us. Well, earlier in the broadcast, we were talking about stars and how humanity often looks to the heavens, you know, the stars and the planets to guide our lives. Anybody, as you were small, or when you were small, I should say, ever sing the song Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star? You know, it's probably one of the first songs that we had heard if we're outside and we're looking up and like, what is all this going on in the sky? Yeah, and then usually a parent or somebody, you know, just starts to sing that song, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Okay. And how many of you have ever made a wish on a shooting star? You know, you just see that, you know, going across the sky and it's like, oh, better make a wish. Okay. Well, like I said, we're fascinated with stars. It's just something that, you know, movies were made about them and TV shows and poetry and other kinds of literature just mention stars left and right. They're just very much a part of who we are. And so we are just fascinated just by looking up at the stars. And as I said, it's, you know, because we have this love as humanity, this love for stars and planets and suns and moons and stuff, of course it makes sense that God's going to put a sign in the night sky to let the shepherds and the magi know what's going on. And we just have those two accounts. We don't know if other people have also seen the star, you know, the Bethlehem star. Herod may have, and he just didn't want anything to do with it. but there's just many other people who may have seen this star and were perhaps drawn to see where Jesus was later on, okay? But for some reason, we have these two accounts, shepherds and wise men. And let's go back to this idea that God was doing something new, unlike anyone had ever seen before. And one of the favorite things that I look at whenever, you know, I hear, or I should say I read in, say, the Bible, that, you know, God is doing something new, or fear not, is usually the two words that follow any kind of announcement that God is doing something new. And it's just interesting, that message of, look, don't be afraid. God's doing something different. You haven't seen it before. You haven't heard it before, but trust it, okay? Just God's going to do something new here, so just hang on. Don't be afraid, okay? And then I like, you know, because as I said, whenever God is doing something new in a person's life or a person's life, I always think of movement or this direction of God. Like, what is God doing now? And how is God drawing close to us? Or, you know, that's the imminence part, that God chooses to draw close to us, that God's involved in our lives and involved in the world. And where in our lives is God drawing close? And it actually pulls us out of ourselves, and we realize that something greater than ourselves is happening. Something greater than ourselves is going on. And what is this new purpose that God wants us to pay attention to? Because you see, whenever God moves towards us or draws close to us, this action always requires a response on our part. It is. Just think back in your own life when you knew somehow, some way, the hand of God touched you. Or somehow, some way, there was an answer to prayer. What was your reaction? Were you drawn closer to God as a result, or were you driven further away from God? Okay, that sounds overly simplistic, but that's usually the direction that we go when there's movement in us as well. But at any rate, when we are touched on God, it calls us to go beyond our limitations and our fears and to reach out to others in genuine love. And we have just countless stories after another of people who, in spite of the circumstances or in spite of what their mind was telling them, like, you can't do this, or society says that you shouldn't, the people went beyond their own limitations and they found out, yes, through the grace of God, I can do this. Yes, it doesn't matter because something deeper, more profound is at work here. And so a lot of people are enabled to go beyond themselves when they are ready. Okay. So we live out this awareness of Christ, this Christ consciousness in everyday, ordinary society. And whenever we're able to do this, we turn the ordinary into the extraordinary. It's how we're able to find God in the most unlikely places, in the most unlikely people. And I had shared with you last year at this time, I think, or a few days afterwards, I was in India. And one of my prayers, you know, the old saying is, if you ever want to make God laugh, just tell God what you want to do. Well, that's what I was doing, in a sense, but very humbly, I thought. And I just said, you know, God, I want to see more of you on this trip. Show me where you are. Show me who you are, and so forth. Okay? And I got out to India, and I was in and around many, many, many people, and just realized that little acts of kindness here and there were just occurring all around me. Even to the point where I had come down from a mountain that I was walking up with my guide, thoroughly exhausted. My knees were screaming, and I just wanted to sit down. And when I did, it was actually at my guide's house where he lived at the base of the mountain. And his mother came out, and she gave me a little cup of chai. And, you know, just your average older woman who is a little hunched over, you know, a well-worn life was etched on her face and in her hands. And yet she had this gentleness, this kindness to her that just was a blessing to me. And I had never seen her before. But she transcended her surroundings, who she is. I transcended mine because it made me just think and appreciate just where do you find God? And that's how the rest of the trip was. I was just seeing God in the most unlikely places through the most unlikely people. And that sounds a little arrogant. I will admit that, you know, how do you find God in the most unlikely people? And I say that because this points directly to our ego, that we think that God has to be found here or there. And if God shows up somewhere else or through somebody else, then it doesn't really count. You know, it's not really real. And again, that's just not true. That's more arrogance that's coming out. And so I was humbled in that you know, that trip to India, just because my definition, as it were, you know, where would I find God was just, first of all, blown up and rewritten by God. And it's almost as if God said, look, you want to find me? You want to see me? You want to hear me? Go into the ordinary. Go into society and look and see for the invisible people. The people who just go throughout their lives and they just are content to go about their every day. And they just kind of blend into the background. That is where you'll find me, as if God was saying to me. So, well, one of my teachers, Robert Wicks, he had shared with me long ago that true ordinariness is tangible holiness. And in the book that he had written, Touching the Holy, he also writes that, yet in spite of the ordinariness, we're invited to follow the will of God by trying to figure out what our inner motivations and talents are, and then express them without reservations and self-consciousness. You know, just go beyond yourself, transcend what you think you can't do. Okay? In fact, he goes on further and he says that the mystical experiences that we have throughout history and what people report on even up until this day are not just reserved for the elite, but rather it's a simple way of living that's available to everyone. And so he too sees the extraordinariness of God played out in our ordinary world, in and through various people and places. So God in Jesus was doing something new, you know, drawing close in a way in which had never been done before, had never been seen before. You see, whenever we have a divine encounter with God, whether it be through worship or prayer or some other means, at some point, we're going to have to live it out. You know, at some point, we're going to have to come down from that mountaintop experience, you know, and at some point, we have to go on with our ordinary life. And at some point, this Bethlehem star went away, and we are left with the ordinary once again. Like I said, we don't know what happened to the shepherds. We don't know what happened to the wise men. Well, we have legends and things like that, but we don't really know. But think about this for a moment. What happens when the extraordinary touches the ordinary? Can our ordinary lives just stay the same? And when something happens to us that's very powerful, and we know that we are never the same because somewhere along the way, God kind of crawled into each and every cell in our body and has just, you know, has transformed us. And we always want to return to, let's say, the scenes of when we were touched or we felt the presence of God, and we want to relive the excitement. And we try to recreate these feelings to kind of stay in that moment. Like, this is so great. I don't ever want to leave this. And we come away forever changed like the shepherds and the wise men. But still, we have to come away from that. We have to come down from the mountain. We have to get back and engage and reengage in society. So you see, the Christmas miracle is more than just coming home, you know, and you know, like after a rock concert or whatever, and just saying, wow, that was a great experience. Let's go back and do it again. It's not like that at all. You know, you just can't say, wow, that was pretty cool. That's a great story. And then act like nothing has changed in your life. I mean, yeah, we're going to get up in the next morning or go about our business as usual, and then we're going to come home and maybe we get up and do it all over again. You know, that's the ordinariness of our lives. But what happens when the extraordinariness of God enters that? You know, that this Christmas miracle and the light that was coming into the world was so unique that even now we are enabled to not only carry this light, but we hold this light every day. And that's what transforms the ordinariness of our lives. It is forever changed. We cannot go back to the way things used to be because we are changing. And having this transformation and this awareness of Christ or this Christ consciousness, it's played out in our relationships. You know, it's played out through forgiveness. It's played out through joy. It's played out through peace or unconditional love or compassion and empathy and grace. We live out these things in relationships with ourselves and learning to be compassionate with ourselves and learning to love ourselves, even learning to forgive ourselves. You know, once we're able to do that, then we are, say, enabled or better able to love others and heal from our woundedness and to help them heal from theirs and learning to love them, learning to forgive them, learning to have more compassion for them and so forth. And until that time, many people struggle with relationships in general. And again, this is nothing new, but this is something that I see, you know, science and especially, you know, psychiatry, you know, has been getting on board with and not playing catch up, but they're trying to put the scientific language to it. And they have done in many different ways. And what I'm thinking of here is from a doctor, Karen Horney. She lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s, or mid 1900s when she died. And she was fascinated also by movement in relationships. And she lived back in the day when, you know, the early days of psychoanalysis, when movement and therapy was often described as, you know, you have an understanding of your own limitations and resolving some sort of unconscious conflict in order to integrate this healthier awareness of your strengths and growing edges, maturity, and just a commitment to developing the self. Okay. And although neurosis, that's a term that's no longer used in the mental health field, Dr. Horney noted that neurosis often develop from basic feelings of anxiety or depression or even irrational fears. And as a result, these negative feelings, the anxiety, the depression, the irrational fears, would then be projected onto others. You know, it's coming from a person who has, let's say, irrational fears, projected onto somebody else whom, let's say, a neurotic person believes is more intelligent or more capable than himself or herself. Okay? And the more she started to see this, the more, you know, it just led her to construct a theory just based on how people act inauthentically towards others by either moving towards them or against them or away from them in their personal relationships. And she asserted that especially children in the early stages of their own human development basically learned four ways of protecting themselves against anxiety. You know, they struggled with, let's say, loneliness, or because they were children, they might have had this sense of helplessness. But she said even children, you know, at this early development, found ways to protect themselves, but she put it in terms of the language of movement. And she said that, you know, some children, secure love and affection by seeking attention and approval from others. Nothing wrong with that, but again, if it goes to the extreme, you know, a person who becomes totally dependent on what other people think about them instead of then growing into more of a developed sense of who they are and learning, you know, affirmation comes from within. Or being submissive in relationships that tend to be just a little overriding. Okay, well, they just like, they might say, I don't have a choice. I can't get away. I'm a child. What am I going to do? So I have to, you know, be involved in the family. I have to be in the family. I just can't get away. So if it wasn't a healthy family, you know, the child did its best to just become submissive in that. And then there's others who wanted to attain power by seeking some sort of prestige or acknowledgement or admiration from others. Or she said the last one, the fourth way, was withdrawing by striving for some sort of perfection as they got a little older. Okay, and she said this is something that, you know, children have a tendency to adapt and, you know, they move either towards, against, or away from people in their relationships. But of course, with kids grow up. So moving toward adulthood, Dr. Horney states that we develop coping strategies that guard against anxiety. Okay. So if we're going to move towards somebody in an unhealthy way, it displays this compliance after admitting their own helplessness. Like, all right, okay, you win. And in spite of any fears of rejection, that person attempts to gain affection of others. And then they learn this dependence, as I mentioned early on. It just they're constantly looking outside themselves to seek that validation. But and moving against others, you know, as we're older, you know, people experience relationships as hostile. And therefore distrust, the feelings and intentions of others towards themselves. They can't trust the relationships. And so they move against that. They just, you know, the world is not a nice place. People can't be trusted. I can't trust my feelings and so on and so forth. And then lastly, she said, as we get older, if things keep going the way they are or how they started in childhood, we may also have a tendency to move away from others. You know, people largely becoming emotionally detached or disconnected from everyday society and just going inward and staying inward. You know, it's just that I'm just going to drop out of society. I'm just going to withdraw. Okay. And again, these are unhealthy ways of, you know, how we move in relationships. And again, that has to come from somewhere. And it is. It's come from irrational fears, this anxiety, depression, and it gets lived out in just being inauthentic until those things are healed and relationships are also healed. Okay, so in terms of this immanence and transcendence, you know, God speaking to the world through this enormous, glorious, very bright, bright star, we can take comfort in the fact that, you know, God loves us so much that he reached out to us first. God spoke to us first. But we also have responsibility then. You know, once we know that somebody is either calling us or needs our help and or whatever it is, it invokes that kind of response in the relationship. Same thing goes on with God. You know, God is speaking and we are then moved or we're drawn to it. Okay. But God has great love for us. That first Christmas story, powerful, powerful moment that even now still touches the hearts and lives of people who hear it or who read it or who are reminded of when they were younger and how they enjoyed listening to that story. It is that powerful. So I hope you are having a very, very Merry Christmas. I'm Dr. James Hauck. You have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I will be back with you next Friday, January the 1st, 2021. We will celebrate the new year together, and we will focus on how do we tell these stories. And think about stories that we've told this past year with COVID and everything else. So I certainly wish you again a Merry Christmas. Everybody be safe, behave yourselves, and keep looking to the stars, for these are indeed God's way of telling stories. Take care, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Hauck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.